Good evening, everybody. My name is Chris, and I am an alcoholic. It's great to be at this group. This isn't my first time here. I was here for a day. Oh, it wasn't a day of sharing. It was Acts of Recovery.
Right.
And I had a good time there. I spent the day hanging out with some of my really good friends, just coming down to the shore in the summer. You know, you can make a production out of it, and that's what we did. So I'm really, really happy to be down here. I am an alcoholic. I'm a textbook, page 2021, big book type alcoholic. And what that means is there's a lot of problems in your life when you're drinking. You know, you're causing a lot of concern for other people in your life. I want to start where I believe my alcoholism started. I really believe that I'm not an alcoholic because I drank a lot. I believe I drank a lot because I'm an alcoholic. And there's a big difference between those two things. And the reason I believe that is because there were some things going on with me in an early age that were that caused me a lot of emotional uncomfortability. Some of those things were, you know, I was very shy. I had a lot of self-centered fear. There were things that just really seemed to make me incredibly uncomfortable. I was unbelievably attached to what I thought your view of me was. You know, if ever I was to do something embarrassing, I would, you know, it would absolutely devastate me that I looked stupid to people. You know, so I was totally attached to whatever perspective I had on what those other people would think. Some examples of this. One of them is: does anybody in here remember square dancing from school? Oh my God! Remember that? Like, it was a gymnasium like this. I'm maybe 10, 12 years old. And they would line the girls up on one side, and they'd line the boys up on the other, and they'd blow the whistle. And the boys were supposed to run across the gym and grab a girl to dance, you know? And, I mean, I don't know about anybody else, but this was too much for me, you know what I mean? And I'm thinking therapists are still making money off of this crazy activity that they had, you know? And, I mean, it was horrifying that I was caught up in this thing. And you know, even today I'm thinking back on it and I'm thinking they don't know what they're doing to the alcoholic who hasn't discovered alcohol yet, you know? They're gonna cause unnecessary suicides. But anyway, you know, things like that. If there was an oral report, I would cut school. There's no way I could get up in front of people and give an oral report. I remember the first day being dropped off for kindergarten, standing there and looking at the other kindergartners. They're standing around, they're playing kickball and tag, and I'm looking at them like, oh my God, there's been a big mistake here. There's no way I can go down and, you know, hang out with them. What if I do something stupid? What if they don't like me? I mean, I was preoccupied with all of this emotional bondage. And the day came, I was about 12 or 13 years old, and the day came, I talked a couple of my buddies into going back to my house, cutting school, and getting drunk. I'd heard it was cool. So what we did is we went back to my house, and I pulled down a bottle of Four Roses whiskey, and I poured out three big water glasses. And I want to tell you what happened to the two other guys I was with before I tell you what happened to me. Because they never became alcoholic. As far as I know, they never became problem drinkers. What they did was they had about two-thirds of their glass, and they were fine. They'd had enough. You ever drink with people like that? Is that the most annoying thing in the world? What do you mean you've had enough? It's only 10:30. Let's go to the city! You know? I mean, that's how I drank. And these guys had enough, and they sat back and they watched the show. Because what I did was I drank my glass, I drank their glasses, I finished the bottle, and I went into my first blackout. I'm like 12 or 13, mind you, and I'm in a blackout. trashing the house, doing all this crazy stuff. Anybody in here a blackout drinker? You know, there's a few of you, right? That is really disconcerting, isn't it? To wake up the next day and there's a whole big part of yesterday that you don't remember. You know, you might not have any I nevers if you're a blackout drinker. Now, there's something to think about. I got so ill from this. Is anybody in here remember the first time you drank way too much hard liquor? I mean, you're poisoned. And I had to remain horizontal for days after this. I mean, you know, I had never projectile vomited in my life before this. So there was all kinds of new things I was learning. But I was unbelievably sick. And now, think about this. Think about if any food or beverage made you that ill, would you ever go near it again, ever, ever? I mean, it would be insane. You know, well, you know, it put me in the hospital for a week, but maybe it won't this time. I mean, it doesn't make any sense. Now, here's the piece of the puzzle. Here's what alcohol did for me. And I don't think it does this for everybody, but it did it for me. All that emotional bondage, all that being attached to and feeling, you know, scared and ashamed and all of this emotional crap that I was living with, being afraid to talk to girls, I mean, you name it. When I started drinking that Four Roses whiskey, all that went away and I became larger than life. My fears fell from me. You know what I'm talking about? I finally felt like I thought all of you felt all the time. Because I thought there was something really wrong with me. Now, there was everything in this bottle for me. It was now a tool that I could use to be able to step out, you know, to be able to do the things that I wanted to. There were dancing lessons in that bottle. You know, the next time there's a square dance, I know how I'm taking care of this, you know. And it's not going to be like some traumatic thing. It's going to be like they can come run across the floor and ask me, you know. I mean, there's like a complete shift in perspective when I started drinking this stuff. So I paid attention to that. I became preoccupied with alcohol. Because the Four Roses made me really sick, I started drinking some other things. But I started to plan my days around when I was going to get drunk the next time, where I was going to get it, you know, who was going to be with me, you know, what it was going to be. I started to become preoccupied with alcohol. It talks about in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous that you cross a line, you cross a line, and the line of demarcation really is that you pass the point of being able to access power, choice, and control where alcohol is concerned. And it also says in there that by the time you want to quit, and if you have crossed that line, there's very little hope of your recovery. You know, without some form of spiritual assistance, you just aren't going to be able to hitch up your bootstraps and stop drinking. You're not going to be able to. And that's what happened to me. I drank for about 20 years. I drank a lot. I had a lot of bad things happen to me. I had a lot of DUIs and a lot of problems at work and, you know, girlfriend problems. And my family didn't understand me and my friends weren't loyal and, you know, all the things that we go through as alcoholics. You know, I'll just tell you one story. This is my last DUI. I'm out drinking with somebody, who I went to college with, hadn't seen him in a long time. He made the mistake of calling me up and saying, "Hey, you doing anything?" And I said, "No, you know, I'm come on over, we'll have a drink." And so he made the mistake of coming over and having a drink with me, and we went out and I made a scene at a bar. It was really embarrassing. We got back to his house. I was supposed to stay there so I wouldn't have to drive, but I got a resentment about something. You know, "What'd you say?" You know, or something like that. So I get in my car and I start driving. Now, here's what happens. Supposedly, I crossed the double yellow. You know how props are, you know. Supposedly, I crossed the double yellow. And the cop pulls me over. He knocks on the window. I roll the window down. I go, "This is really long." And he goes, "You crossed the double yellow, you know, license, registration, insurance card." And I lean in to you know, the glove compartment looking for the license, registration, insurance card. Now, I'm drunk out of my mind, right? And I can't find it. Or it's in there or somewhere. So I'm fumbling around, and finally I just give up, and I just grab the entire contents of the glove compartment. I just go, "Here." And there's maps and hairbrushes and, you know, and tissue paper and, you know, "Here, it's in there, you know. Out of the car." You know how cops are. They're always hassling you. So I end up, you know, anybody here remember hazy recollections? You know what I'm talking about? Like, you kind of remember a little, but, you know, there's some details that are a little fuzzy. Well, that's what happened to me. I was taken to the police station. They gave me a sobriety test. And I remember one thing from the sobriety test. I aced the ABCs. I nailed them. Okay? So I wake up the next morning with a summons in my pocket, which was not that unusual, unfortunately. And I'm indignant about this whole thing. I can't believe I was pulled over only 10 blocks from my house. You know, and rah, rah, I'm going to fight this. So I hire an attorney, and he's like a $1,500 attorney. We're talking like 1983. That was a lot of money back then. And he comes in his three-piece suit, and he shows up, and we go up to the police station, because the first thing you need to do is you need to view the video, okay? Anybody in here ever seen their DUI video? I will warn you right now, that's not something you're prepared to see. I'm thinking I did a good job, okay? I sit down, the cop brings the VHS tape to my lawyer, and as he hands it to the lawyer, he sniggers. He goes like this, right? That was a bad sign. He puts it in the TV and punches the button, and I'm like horrified. I am so drunk. There's parts of it where, you know, they're having me walk a line and I got my arms on a wall and, you know, it was just unbelievable. You know, it would definitely be number one on YouTube if it still existed. Anyway, it gets to the ABCs, which I've still got some hope, you know, because I remember, and I nailed the ABCs, all right. Here's how I nailed them. A, B, can I have a cigarette? C. Oh, it was horrible. So I'm like cringing, and the whole time this $1,500 lawyer, you know, he's like very professional, taking notes. You know, he's really, you know, he's you know, I'm getting my money's worth. It gets to the end of this test, and the cop says to me, "Is there anything else you'd like to add? Because we're going to turn the camera off. So is there anything you'd like to add?" And here I am. I look over at the camera and I go, like this, right? I'm like, ah. And the lawyer, who had been really professional up to this point in time, just loses it. He's like, "Bah! That's so funny. I can't believe it. I've never seen anything like this in 20 years. I've never seen anything like this. Oh, if we had any chance at all, you know." And I guess we'll have to plea this one. But these weren't like isolated incidents. I was shooting myself in the foot like this on a constant basis. Being an alcoholic, you gotta learn how to get through those things, you know, and be able to stand looking at yourself in the mirror. You know, so I blamed it on the cop, and on, you know, that cop, you know. Today, I gotta tell you, there's been a shift in perception, you know, with a spiritual awakening, basically comes a shift in perception. I gotta tell you, I drive on the road today. Anybody as drunk as I was in that video needs to be stopped. You know what I mean? They're going to plow into a family and kill them. You know, so it's a complete shift in perception from recovery. But over the years, in any considerable period of time, things get worse for an alcoholic. They don't get better over any considerable period of time. So if you look at my drinking from when I started in like 1970 or whatever, and you look to where I stopped in 1989, you're gonna see a progression of where I'm drinking more and I'm having more problems and I'm isolating more. My life is getting smaller, and the way I feel about myself is just deteriorating. Every bit of quality in my life had deteriorated. Now, you know, I also started drinking, you know, like I say, 1969 or 1970. And this was a period of time where there was a lot of drug use, at least with the people that I was hanging out with. And I need to say this. I'm an alcoholic. I don't identify myself as a drug addict, because when the time and the place came to quit drugs, I was able to. With a sufficient desire, I was able to stop smoking an ounce of pot a day. You know, because it was just getting to be too much, because all I was doing was sitting around the house watching Love Boat reruns, you know, eating brownies, you know. So I was able to just stop that. And, you know, when the LSD got a little bit too spooky for me, I just stopped. And, you know, when the cocaine got too expensive and the people I was hanging around with who didn't really have names, you know, when that just got a little bit too much for me, I separated from that. But, you know, I was very irresponsible with them. You know, I will tell you that. I've had some experiences. I remember the Quaalude epidemic of 72. And this is at our school, Ridge High in Basking Ridge. And here's what had happened. This friend of mine had gotten, and if anybody doesn't know what a Quaalude is, picture drinking a six-pack of Tallboy malt liquors in 30 seconds. That's what one Quaalude will do to you, all right? Now, this guy brings in a sack of these things, and he puts them down at the smoking area, you know, and we're all, you know, in the morning, what are those? Oh, those are Quaaludes. Oh, Quaaludes. Well, great, I'll buy some, you know. And, you know, how many do you take? And he didn't know, because his brother gave them to him really late that night. So he goes, I don't know, three or four. So about 50 of us took three or four Quaaludes before first period in high school. The ambulance was back and forth all day. It was a mess. But, you know, I remember walking down the hall with my arms on the locker going, oh, and I figured, you know, this is just too much. This is just too much. I'm going to make a break for it. Okay? So I see the exit. And I go, I'm going to make a break, and I'm going to make it out to the woods. And that's what I do. I break through the doors, and I head for the woods. Now, the one thing I'd not really thought very clearly about was that I was running past the entire 400 wing of the high school. So about 300 students got to see me heading for the woods. And they got a big kick out of it. They told me the next day. They go, Chris, it was beautiful. It took you like 5 minutes to get 100 yards, you know? And I thought I was moving, you know? Oh, what a mess. And, you know, I could go on and on and on like this. The strange thing is that there was negative consequences to all this stuff. I mean, I was never really successful at anything. Something always bad would happen. But the sane idea of, hey, this is causing me trouble, I should look at this, wasn't accessible to me. It's not something that I thought about. When I got my third DWI, the first thing I thought was, I gotta stop driving. You know? I mean, it's not like, you know, alcohol has completely ruined my life, and I'm going to be walking until there's Jetson mobiles. You know, that's not what I was thinking. I was thinking that lousy cop, and you know, the motor vehicle laws. This isn't a good state to drive in. You know, I mean, you know, I did not consider the fact that I should separate from alcohol. Now, what happened was, I was going down the scale fast. Again, I'm a textbook alcoholic. And, you know, you want to read in the chapter to wives, the type 1, 2, 3, and 4. I was all a 3 and half a 4. I mean, I was, you know, really, really in bad shape. I need to be detoxed if I quit drinking. It was really ugly. And it got to the point where I had to start looking at separating from alcohol. I'd lost my license 3 times. I'd totaled 9 cars in drunken blackouts. I've been thrown out the front window, the passenger window. I was even thrown out the back window of my car one time. I was always the final owner of anything I ever drove. I had to ask my sponsor how to sell a car when I was in sobriety, because I knew about giving the title to the junk man, but I didn't know about how to sell one, you know? So, I mean, you know, my personal relationships were in the toilet. I lost all of my friends. I had a family. I had a family that I loved very, very much. They headed for the hills because of me. You know, I mean, all of this stuff. I was a terrible, terrible employee. I was an electrician, okay? I don't even know how that happened. I mean, that's a really, really bad trade to be in when you shake like this in the morning because you're not drinking. I'd blow stuff up on a daily basis. I was electrocuting myself. My hair was like permanently sticking up. Looked like Ignatowski, you know, from Taxi. And I would do crazy, crazy things. I remember this one time I was working, I was working on a house, and we were changing the electrical service. And the guy I was working with just hated me. He thought I was like the lamest guy he'd ever been with. I'm always sick, or, you know, I can't remember anything. You know, I'm always like shattered. So he hated working with me. So he was messing around in the truck, and I was working on the electrical meter on the side of the house. And the night before, I had allowed myself to be overserved. You know how that is. And there was some drugs and some alcohol involved. And all of a sudden, I started to go like, you know, and I had prior experience with this. I knew I had 8.3 seconds to get somewhere because I was going to get sick, right? And I don't want my buddy to see me, you know. I don't want to look more lame than I already am to him. So I get the idea, I'm going to tear ass around the back of the house, you know. So that's what I do. I just make it around the back of the house and, whoa! I'd been drinking grape drink that morning. So I stuccoed the back of his house with purple vomit. Okay, just blah. It was like a fire hydrant, and I look over, and you know, not from here to the drum set is an adjoining deck with a family. Okay, the mother, the father, and the 3 kids, and they all had the same expression on their face. They were like, "And mommy, mommy, the purple puke monster from hell, mommy." Now, you know. I mean, how many stupid things do you have to do in your life? What finally happened was, I did what all real macho, you know, happening guys do when they're 32. I decided, you know, mom needs some help around the house. You know, I think I should move home. Because the cops were after me, there was warrants, you know, I hadn't done community service, there was bills, you know, I didn't have any money, I owed rent. So I ended up moving back in with my mother for only 8 years of my last drinking, you know, so I burnt the house down twice. But what happened, what was really, really disturbing, was Christmas 1989. My brother, sister, nieces, nephews, you know, the whole family, cats, everything. There's presents under the Christmas tree, and, you know, the Yuletide carols are playing, and everybody's, you know, real nice to each other, and the stockings are hung by the chimney with care, you know what I mean? It's like, so this beautiful, and I start drinking whiskey, and I get a resentment, okay, you know, like, what'd you say? You know, kind of a resentment, and I go into I'm in a blackout, and I go into a violent, you know, insane tirade where I threaten all their lives. I'm going to kill all, you know. I'm going to kill you! And what happened was they left. They said, this guy is nuts, and they just left, and they took their Christmas elsewhere. And I was caught up on like a 5-day drunk. I mean, a 5-day blackout drunk. And when I came out of this, I was wondering where everybody was. You know, I was going into the DTs. It was not pretty. And I remember making some calls and finding out, you know, what happened, piecing this together. Now, I've been through a lot, but the idea that I could kill the people who are still sticking with me, that I have the most affection I have for any human beings on the planet, got my attention. And I had been to AA, I'd been to treatment, I'd been to outpatient, you know, there was some attempts in my life to try to get sober. They were really they were really filled with misunderstanding and not really the right motives. But I knew I had to get back to Alcoholics Anonymous. I knew I did. And I came back in right after New Year's in 1990. I think New Year's was my first day back to meetings. I came back with a willingness that was born of desperation. I knew I was going to die if I continued to drink. And I knew that I was getting really dangerous. And I also thought I was losing my mind, because why would you do something like that? You know, threaten your family. So I knew I was in a lot of trouble. And the thing about alcoholism is, inherent in alcoholism is an almost inability to assess how much trouble you personally are in. If you're new in here tonight, or if you have not been through the 12-step recovery program, there's two things that I know that you're not going to understand. One of them is, you're in way more trouble than you think you are. Okay? However much trouble you think you are, multiply that by 10 and you'll be getting pretty close. Because alcoholism is an absolutely devastating illness. It's running roughshod over every area of your life. Your ability to be, to have any quality in your life, alcohol is just ripping the fabric of your quality of life apart. And you can't see it, because inherent in alcoholism is an almost utter inability to be able to accurately assess where you are with alcoholism and just how much it's affecting you. It's an illness of minimization. You know, I work with a lot of guys. And some of them are in real trouble. Some of them have had multiple DUIs. They're getting thrown out of the house. They've lost a job. They got no money. They're living at the Salvation Army, and they'll want to come work with me. You know, and I'll say, okay, I'll be happy to work with you. Let's talk a little bit about step one. Do you realize that, you know, you're suffering from a progressively fatal illness, that unless it's put in remission through spiritual means, it's going to take you out and you're going to go out ugly? You know, cancer at least allows you the dignity of putting your affairs in order before you check out. Alcoholism, you go out at the bottom of your game. You know what I mean? You go out pathetic. And anybody that's still around you either resents you or pities you. You know, who wants to go out that way? So I'm explaining this to the new guy, and I'm basically saying, you know, we die in horrible, horrible ways, and you are powerless over this. You don't have access to power, choice, and control. You can't just say, I'm not going to drink anymore, and have that mean anything. You are caught up in something that's going to just run over you. Do you understand that? Yeah. Okay, well, I want you to start coming over to my house, you know, a couple of nights a week, and we're going to start working out of the big book. I want you to get consistent with meetings. You know, we're really going to be looking at some of the things that are going on in your life. Oh, wow, man. You know, that sounds like pretty intense. You know, like Tuesday nights, I get my feet scraped, and, you know, Thursday night's a basketball game, and, you know, I'd come over this weekend, but I'm going to a dead show. You're dying. You know, you're dying. What don't you understand about your dying? They can't get it. inherent in alcoholism is the utter inability to really see how much trouble you're in. So if you're new, or you haven't been through the 12 steps and had a spiritual awakening as the result of the 12 steps, you're in way more trouble than you think you are, without question. The good news is, the other thing that's true, that's very difficult to understand as someone who doesn't have a lot of recovery experience, is the answers in Alcoholics Anonymous are going to be much more significant for you than you're giving them credit for. You know, when I walked into AA, I thought, you know, maybe I'll be able to, like, stop drinking, you know, maybe. I don't know what it is, what's going on with these church basements and all these idiots, you know, morons, but I'll go, you know. And I was just thinking that maybe I could separate from alcohol. Alcohol is a symptom of the illness, alcoholism. And I'll tell you what, the illness always comes before the symptom. So what I didn't understand in the early days was that I thought my problem was drinking too much. My drinking too much was in reaction to the emotional alcoholic burden that I was carrying inside my spiritual being. Okay? I was uncomfortable with sobriety. I was uncomfortable with sobriety. I couldn't stand sobriety. You know, I mean, think about this. Think about this. Go back into your drinking a little bit. And think about, like, when you were on the way home from work and you need to stop at a liquor store, you need to stop at the bar. I mean, you might as well go in there and say, "Bartender, quick! You know, double me up. You know, I want three. I want back it up with a couple of Budweisers, three shots. You know, I want them all right here because you may not get back here in time and I got a problem. I'm sober. Help me out with this." You know what I mean? Now, is it the alcohol that's the problem? Or is it the sobriety? That's the issue. I was uncomfortable in a sober state of mind. And what I wasn't giving Alcoholics Anonymous credit for, or didn't believe it was going to be able to help with, was that emotional, spiritual, psychic, mental trauma that I was going through sober. I didn't think Alcoholics Anonymous was going to be able to help me. It's very, very difficult to understand a spiritual experience intellectually. Okay? One of the toughest things that you do as a sponsor or as somebody carrying a message into an institution or whatever is to try to talk about recovery. Try to explain that to people because it's so difficult to understand it. Especially, you know, if you still have a lot of resistance to this AA stuff, then it's very, very difficult to get in. I learned that you need to understand recovery experientially. You can learn a lot intellectually, but I got to tell you, I've sponsored some guys that know more about the Big Book. They can quote the Big Book. They have the Big Book memorized, and they're taking people through the Big Book high on heroin. You know what I mean? I mean, I swear, it's happened to me. You know, just constantly realize what they've done is they've turned the book Alcoholics Anonymous into an intellectual exercise. They don't really understand it because they haven't done it. The book Alcoholics Anonymous is a textbook. How many of us address the book Alcoholics Anonymous like it's a textbook? I know when I first came into AA, the Big Book was something you got in rehab and you had people sign and you put it up on the shelf and it collected dust. And you went to the 12 and 12 meeting. You know, I mean, that's what we did back in the early 90s up in my area. Now, if it's the basic text of the fellowship, think about it like this. Let's say you want the calculus experience. You really, really have need of the things that calculus can offer you. And you decide to start going to class to calculus class. And you sit in the calculus class and, you know, you share and you drink coffee and you hang out with other calculus people. And when there's a calculus dance, you go to the calculus dance and you're grateful for calculus. But you never open up the textbook and you never solve any of the problems. You never do any of the work in the textbook. You're not going to get a calculus experience. It's not going to be applicable to you in your life. You're not going to be able to use those tools because you haven't learned them. In Alcoholics Anonymous, it is not uncommon for somebody with 20 years to say, I never read the big book. You know, I've been in Calculus 1 for 20 years. The hell with that textbook. You know, it's unbelievable. And the thing is sometimes you just don't know what you don't know. Because it's experiential, the process of recovery, because it's experiential, it's really difficult to understand if you haven't experienced it. You know, try describing the colors of a rainbow to a blind man. You know, it's very, very difficult. Now, here's what happened to me. This buddy of mine, Radio Shack Mike, everybody had nicknames back then, gave me a set of tapes. He gave me these 8 90-minute tapes. He says, you're hardcore, dude, man. You listen to these. And, I'm thinking, I've got a long ride to work. Why not? You know, I'll give it a try. And I put these tapes in. And these tapes were an early Joe and Charlie workshop. You know, this meeting and a lot of other meetings, are here basically because of the Renaissance that was started by Joe and Charlie in 1978. That's a very unique story in itself. But basically, these two guys from Arkansas started going around to conventions around the country and asking if they could have a room where they would do a big book study. You know, everything else is like the speakers, you know, telling the stories, doing their comedy routine stories. And that's really what it was about. And then there was the Joe and Charlie guys in this back room. Now, what happened was somebody recorded it. Recognized the validity, recognized just how big this thing is that they're talking about. They're talking about an actual recovery process that had been almost forgotten in Alcoholics Anonymous. This guy made a whole bunch of tapes and at the next convention strategically planted it at certain tables for certain states. So he knew everybody. He knew everybody in this convention. He goes, I'm going to give these to Harry from Minnesota. I'm going to give these to this guy over in California. And basically what happened was when these people started to listen to these tapes, it started the renaissance of getting back to the book Alcoholics Anonymous as a recovery process. What had happened in the 50s, 60s, 70s, what had happened was Alcoholics Anonymous, which was a program of 12 steps with a support fellowship, what happened was it flipped somewhere along the line, and it became a fellowship with maybe a program if you're lucky enough to be in front of somebody that could explain it to you or has had that experience itself. There was a 40-year deterioration of the program in Alcoholics Anonymous, and Joe and Charlie started it. So I don't know what I have here with these tapes. I just start to listen to them. And, you know, these guys are from Arkansas. I don't particularly care for that, you know. Arkansas, you know. And I don't care for that. So I've got a little contempt prior to investigation going on. But I start to listen. And I get a big resentment because this is what they hit me with right between the eyes. Chris, your fellowship, you're the pope of the fellowship, you know. You're great at the dances, and you're the secretary here, and you're driving the boobies to the hatch here, and, you know, you're doing all this stuff. All that stuff is great. All that stuff is fellowship. If you're not working the program out of the book Alcoholics Anonymous, you do not have an AA program, because that is what an AA program is. So when you go back out, don't tell anybody that AA doesn't work, because you've never worked it. Now, when they hit me between the eyes with this message, I got to tell you, I was a little upset because I was going to 14 meetings a week. People were patting me on the head. Chris, you're doing really good. You know, I had like a year and a half. Oh, you know, you're not as crazy as you were before. You know, you're not as violent. You know, and so people were telling me I was doing really good. But what was happening was I was dying inside. Do you know how you felt before you got to the bartender? Because you were sober. That's how I felt going to 14 meetings a week. I still had that, all that emotional crap. I was still completely attached to what you thought of me. I was still unbelievably shy and ashamed and guilty and depressed and anxious. That was all over me. The meetings weren't treating that. There were some things that happened in my life, you know, but what I did was I put those tapes to the side because I thought, you know, this isn't how we do it in New Jersey. You know, my sponsor, Horatio Horsefeather, you know, if he didn't tell me about this stuff, it must not be, you know what I mean? So I didn't pay any attention to it. I hit an emotional bottom. Anybody in here in sobriety been in the barrel? Like two or three things happen at once. There are huge, unbelievable upheavals in your life that are just like crushing. Well, that's what happened to me. And I got to the point where I had three options. Kill myself. Okay? Kill myself. Drink to overcome this burden of self. Or try to find a solution to this, because there's got to be something that can help me. And I remembered the message in these tapes. And, you know, basically what I did was I took the tapes out, I opened up a brand new big book, or the big book I went to rehab with that I never read, and I started going through it line by line, paragraph by paragraph, and when there was an instruction, I would stop. I would do that instruction or go off and do that instruction, and then I would come back. I actually started to use it like you would use a textbook. Because I was out of options. I was out of plans. This was not out of virtue. You know, this wasn't to become a better person. This was to keep from killing myself. You know, and what happened was there was I started to undergo what the spiritual experience talks about in the appendix, the educational variety of spiritual awakening, because it happened slowly over the course of time. I'd say it took me about 4 months to get through the steps. But what I did was, you know, I held nothing back in the fourth and the fifth step. I went out and I made amends. I made amends to bosses that I, ex-girlfriend. I went around the world, you know, making these crazy amends that I was scared to death to make. I started to learn disciplines of prayer and meditation, and I started because I had sponsees at this period of time. Things are changing in my life, but they were changing slowly. I mean, I couldn't tell on a day-to-day basis I was getting better. But over a period of time, I looked back, and all that emotional stuff that was killing me was being treated through this 12-step process. And I started to behave differently. I started to think differently. Really, what a spiritual awakening is, it's a shift in perception. You no longer perceive things the way you used to. You're not under attack by a hostile universe. You know what I mean? You're your own problem. You know, you are the cause of your woes. It's your problem. You need to look at it. And so going from everybody's an ass to, wow, you know, this really is my problem, is a shift in perception. And a lot of those happened, as I started to go through the process. But it was slow and it was subtle. It was over the course of 6 months, maybe a year. But what happened was, I was sponsoring by this time because one of the things I learned in AA early on was how to give good share. You know what I mean? I got really good at the share. and I'd raise my hand and I'd be real self-deprecating, you know, and I'd share some of my little faults and how stupid I was this week, ha ha ha, you know, and, you know, love all you people, and, you know, so that everyone would like me, you know, that type of share where, you know, you don't want anybody to be upset with you. It's got to be like good share. And, you know, I learned how to do that, and so I had some sponsees. Some of these poor bastards are still alive. And you know, because sometimes the tugboat with the most steam is going to end up getting the tow jobs. And what happened was they were drinking on me, a lot of these guys. Okay, you ever have your guys drink on you? Isn't that unbelievable? Does that make you look bad, you know, in the group? You know, somebody will come up to you, is Harry yours? You know, he's drinking and he's hitting on the new women and he's borrowing money. Yeah, Harry's mine. I'll talk to him, you know. And this was happening to me all the time. So the thought crosses my mind that I would start to bring people over to my house and start going through the book Alcoholics Anonymous like I went through and see if it will be helpful maybe to them too. You gotta understand, I didn't know what the hell I was doing back then, but for some crazy reason, I was doing the right things. I learned something very significant after a period of about 2 or 3 years working with a lot of guys, because people started to hear, hey, Chris is doing this thing in his house, you know, you ought to check it out. So all of a sudden everybody's showing up at my house. Here's the thing that I learned that was very, very significant. The people that were actually able to get through the fourth and the fifth step, the eighth and the ninth step, learn about the disciplines of 10 and 11, and actually go out and work with other people. You know, actually is a beautiful word to put in front of any step. You know, actually made direct amends. You know, I mean, it's a good word to use. But the people who actually went out and did this stuff, every single one of them is still in AA today. They're card-carrying members in good standing. They've got their sponsees. They're consistent at meetings. You know, they're keeping up with their spiritual disciplines. And here's the really good part. Their quality of life is out the roof. Doesn't necessarily mean they're making a lot of money or they're not making a lot of money, or, you know, they're married or they're getting divorced. None of those things really matter. But when you see these people, they're fundamentally at depth happy. You know what I mean? They're content. They have a spirituality. They have a real quality to their life. So I learned more working with others, really, than I did with myself. There's so much in Alcoholics Anonymous. There's so much to be offered to you in Alcoholics Anonymous. The sky is the limit in here. It really is. And, you know, to get stuck in a group like I did early on, where you go in there, you know, and you walk in, you get your coffee, and you sit down, and, you know, it's a resentment meeting. Everybody's resentment, blah, blah, blah. Share, resentment, blah, 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 blah. You know, I'll see you next week, you know. I mean, to get stuck in a meeting like that, you have to know there's so much more available in Alcoholics Anonymous than that. I mean, you know, I really thought for the first year or so in AA, AA was like a big pep rally. You know, like, yay, we don't drink today. And we just kind of keep encouraging each of us to not drink. You know, you don't drink and I'll not drink. And well, you're both powerless, you know, so how's that going to work? You know what I mean? Admitted we were powerless. If you're powerless, you're powerless. You can't not drink. You know what I mean? So how is encouraging me to not drink gonna help? It's not, because I'm an alcoholic. You know, but that's what I thought AA was. I thought it was like, you know, a giant huddle. Like, yeah, you huddle up. All right. First things first. Yeah, keep it simple, easy. Does it? See you back here tomorrow. Break. You know, and it's just there's. If you're in a group like that, you know, I cast no stones, I definitely don't judge. If you're in a group like that, run like hell, okay? Because you might be alcoholic, and you know, if indeed you are alcoholic, you're going to die in one of those groups. But, you know, I'm not about to judge. I almost didn't make it. You know, we're all here by seconds and inches. When you look back at it, there's little things that happened that allowed you to stay, and there was little, you know, coincidences that if they didn't happen, you know, your life wouldn't work out this way and you wouldn't be where you are right now. You know, all the way back from Bill Wilson on up, you know, there's been things like that for me. If this guy, Radio Shack Mike, didn't hand me those tapes, you know, maybe I would have only had two options, drink or kill myself, you know. But there's so much to offer in AA. You know, what is it like what happened? What is it like today for me? My life is absolutely extraordinary today in so many ways. I have, for one reason or another, I've ended up in situations that just blow my mind. One of them is, you know, I went from being a really bad electrician to working my way up and being in charge of almost 80 New York City schools, the whole maintenance and physical plant and contracts and union negotiations, all this crazy stuff. I was like in charge of the, you know, this was huge, going from somebody who couldn't put an electrical meter on the side of the house to having a really big job like this. You know, I was able to do that, and it wasn't like I was going after that. I didn't, you know, make a decision to, like, climb the ladder. You know, I wasn't paying attention. I was in meetings, you know. But what happened was it ended up happening. You know, I kept being offered these positions. And that's been extraordinary. But in January of 2008, I was offered the opportunity to get involved in a startup that has to do with the professional alcoholism and addiction treatment field. In effect, this very large organization came to me and said, look, if, you know, we would like you to do this. If you can get it started, you know, and you get it to a point where it's actually working, we'll fund it and we'll actually pay you. And this was amazing for me because I started to go all around the world and meet some of the people who are the absolute top people in alcoholism and drug addiction treatment. I mean, these are the people who own the rehab chains and write the criteria for the medical textbooks. And, I mean, these are like the top people, and I'm like wandering around with these guys. It's just been an unbelievable experience for me. And every single day, something amazing happens. You know, I was asked to be a board member of the National Council on Alcoholism. You know, so I'm a National Council on Alcoholism board member. Right? Just crazy, crazy things. And when I mean crazy, in the late 80s, you wouldn't have put me in charge of a lemonade stand. You know what I'm saying? I would have screwed it up. I would have poisoned the customers or something, you know. I couldn't have managed the lemonade stand. And today there are things coming at me every single day that are absolutely extraordinary. Every single positive thing in my life is a direct result of consistent meetings, working the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and carrying the message of those 12 steps to the still sick and suffering alcoholics. Who would have thought that by just working a simple spiritual program and then trying to be of help, that I would get everything that I ever wanted in my life? That doesn't make any sense. It doesn't make any sense. You know, I've read enough self-help books to know that you got to win through intimidation, you know? It just didn't make any sense to me, but it's happened. It's happened in my life. Every single positive thing is a direct result of what I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous from some very, very experienced Alcoholics Anonymous members. You know, there may be some people in here tonight that love Alcoholics Anonymous as much as I do, but there's no one in here tonight that loves Alcoholics Anonymous more than I do. Thank you very, very much for having me here tonight.